Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Program Advisory Committee meets the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Tomorrow Will Be, Friday, May 10th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Old Church Concert Hall in Portland. Tomorrow Will Be is an all-ages event presented as the final show of Boom Art's multi-generational Festive Revolution season. This song-sharing and community celebration is inspired by the project Primer for a Failed Superpower. Following the performance, the audience is invited to meet with local activists and organizations at the Social Justice Fair. Again, that's Tomorrow Will Be, Friday, May 10th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Old Church Concert Hall, 1422 Southwest 11th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from the People's Food Co-op, a community-owned, values-driven natural food cooperative open daily from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m., featuring farm-direct organic produce from more than 30 local farms, bulk foods, and a weekly farmers market every Wednesday year-round. They're located at Southwest Tibbetts Street and 21st Avenue in Portland for almost 50 years. For more information, you can find them online at peoples.coop, that's C-O-O-P, and the Dirt Bag is coming up next.
Okay, boy, it's Glenn Andreessen here beside you now with the Dirt Bag, and we are playing musical chairs. Actually, it's not musical chairs, it's squeaky chairs this morning on Dirt Bag, the Dirt Bag. I have a squeaky chair, so please forgive that. I tried another one, but it's worse. Okay, Jim's back in the co-pilot saddle.
Good morning, Glenn. Glad to be here.
Jim's returned from New Zealand, a couple weeks ago now, I guess.
Yeah, it seemed like almost 4 weeks because I just...
Oh, you just missed that last one. That's right. Okay. So we'll get a report on what he found there. And let's see, what else we've got? Our plant of the month is apricots. Jim has been doing some trials on that, and so we'll see where he's on that. And I spoke last night at the Clark County Master Gardeners group on how I garden in small spaces, and then I said I don't grow apricots, and there was probably 100 people there, and I asked if there were, who grew apricots. Nobody raised their hand, and one person raised their hand and said, "I just cut one down." So, it's sure we can grow them here, but do we get fruit? That's the question.
Well, even actually growing them
it's a little tougher too.
Is actually the big question. Yeah.
Oh, is that right?
First the tree, then the fruit.
Well, I didn't have a problem with the tree growing. I had it for about 10 years and got 8 apricots or something. That's hardly worth the space.
I can't wait to hear from listeners who have apricots.
Yeah.
Because I want to find them.
I doubt we.
We don't have one growing at our place. Well, we do, but we, for several years, many years, we've never had an apricot tree that would survive more than 2 years.
I see. Okay. So that's that. Then we got hot weather coming, and we'll talk about watering, kind of critical. I think there's still quite a bit of ground moisture, but still the top few inches are going to dry out pretty quickly on that. Jim's got a scientifically based garden stumper. We'll talk about that. And I thought I'd mention how I plant tomatoes in the second half, because it's time. If you have a gardening question, feel free to call us 503-231-8187. Our ace engineer here will get right on that. Also, we have our if I don't forget it, it seems like I always forget this, the Dirtbag Dictionary term, and we're going to talk about day neutral. Jim, do you know anything about day neutral?
Only a little bit. I mean,
strawberries.
I refer to strawberries. That
I printed out an article from the OSU
good.
Extension, and it's. I'll just give you a little teaser right here. Botanists used to think that the length of daylight a plant was exposed to determined whether a plant would form flowers, but experiments proved otherwise. It's the length of darkness that a plant experiences that plays the most crucial role.
Wow.
Isn't that interesting?
It is.
Yeah, so we'll talk about what day neutral is, and I have some examples of vegetables and whatnot. Mm-hmm. I do have one announcement about an event that's happening, and if you have an event that you would like us to announce on the Dirtbag that has to do with garden-related stuff, feel free to send me that information in care of KBOO here, and you can get an email at KBOO as well. This is the Multnomah County Master Gardener's Incredible Edibles plant sale from seedling to supper. Grow your own. This is this Saturday, May 11th, 10 until 3 at the Westminster Presbyterian Church, 1624 Northeast Hancock Street, right off Broadway, or close to that. Here's what they're saying here. All plant starts at the Incredible Edibles plant sale are organic, locally grown varieties specifically selected to thrive in our Pacific Northwest conditions. So when you pick up something for dinner, you'll be harvesting nutritious, fresh-picked goodness for your table. Look for a luscious array of both heirlooms and hybrids among the proven varieties of tomatoes, cucumbers, peppers, lettuces, herbs, edible flowers, and more. There will be more than 250 varieties at this event, many especially recommended by OSU Extension Service for their disease resistance, flavor, and productivity. And on that, too, they're going to have some workshops scheduled throughout the day. Master Gardeners will be instructing those, and there is a kids' grow station with hands-on garden activities and discoveries for the little sprouts. Once again, this Saturday, 10 to 3 at the Westminster Presbyterian Church, 1624 Northeast Hancock. I suppose you can get more information by visiting the Multnomah Master Gardeners website.
That sounds like fun.
And a good place to pick up veggie starts.
Yeah.
I've just been so busy with bee stuff that I haven't done a whole lot of starting yet. I do have my tomatoes and peppers started.
Well, we've been doing the same thing out at the nursery. We've got lots of veggies going, almost in the ground.
Almost in the ground, yeah. Okay, so let's try apricots. We gave you a little teaser there that Jim is doing some trials.
Well, apricots is a really big subject, and I can't think of very many fruits that I like better than a fully ripe apricot. Just imagine it. I mean,
oh, I can imagine it. In fact, I've experienced it.
Have you?
Well, was in Le Grand. Have I told you this story that
no.
I have a bachelor's degree from Eastern Oregon University?
I didn't know that.
Yes, and the last 2 years I was there, I was on the 5-year program. I was rented a room with a roommate in the basement of a family. He happened to be the district attorney for Union County. Hmm. Nice guy. And they had an apricot tree in their backyard. And I remember two things about the yard, particularly. One is this apricot tree, and I just remember gorging myself on apricots. And the other was when I saw my first total eclipse of the sun from that backyard. I mean, it was cloudy, so you didn't really even see, but it got dark.
You knew something was happening.
Yes, right. Uh-huh. So they can grow over there, or did anyway.
Yeah. So if you want to get a fully ripe apricot is a real treat and rarely available here west of the Cascade Mountains. I mean, if you go to a store and buy apricots, they look like something. They're orange, firm typically, and rather flavorless, and just a very poor example of what a real apricot can taste like. So we do, just for example, what we do to get apricots is you can drive about 2 hours east of Portland. Uh-huh. To Highway 97, the Biggs Junction, take the bridge across the river to Washington, and at the end of the bridge, there's a little fruit stand, and in late June is usually when they start becoming available, into July. Ask for the seconds, because the ones that they have for they consider rejects are actually the best, the sweetest, the juiciest.
Because they're riper.
Oh man, they are so good. Anyway, that's our way of getting apricots right now. But
so what's plan B?
Plan B is to is to find or create one that will do it here on the west side of the Cascade Mountains.
So what are we up against?
Weather. We have wet winters and springs, and it's just really tough for them. They're, of all the members of the group of plants we call stone fruits, which includes cherries and peaches and nectarines and plums and almonds and all those, apricots are I would say, without a doubt, the most difficult to grow west of the Cascade Mountains.
And it's a weather issue because of disease or temperature?
Yes. Weather is disease, because we have bacterial canker, blossom blast, other things happen to them. Apricots typically bloom early. Flowers are hurt by rain, the excessive amount that we get. But a bigger problem is the actual survival of the tree. And as I mentioned earlier, it's rare to find one, I believe, here.
Well, I've told you about this tree on Northeast 18th that's 100 years old, and its diameter is some 3 or 4 feet.
Yeah, you know, and I remember growing up in Northeast Portland where there was one around the block from me, but they're not common. And I think think by the maybe they get a few years under them, they can survive better than when they're young.
Is it the diseases then that do them in early?
Yes. Absolutely.
Okay, so they just don't have the foliage to support the root growth, or
no? They just get hurt by canker that just that destroys the cambium layer around the trunk and we are initiating an apricot variety trial. I think the first time it's ever been done on the west side of the Cascades, of the extent that we're doing it. We right now have 105 varieties.
Gosh.
And we're planting seeds as well.
I hope you back up your computer's records.
Yeah. We're actually also in the process of hiring somebody to help us with this, because it's a really big project. But our ultimate goal is first we want to find trees that will reliably survive. And we've been growing them. This project has started about 2 years ago, so we have already some good candidates. And then once we have surviving trees, of course, then the second step is to have fruit. It's also interesting. Apricot breeding is an interesting subject. There's only a very few people in the world doing this. One in New Jersey, a very interesting man who's very passionate about it, and we've become good friends with him. And on our trip to New Zealand, we met a second apricot breeder, who has done some remarkable work down there with apricots. I was actually eating apricots in early April, which would be equivalent of October here. I was pigging out on apricots in New Zealand, which blew me away.
Why is that unusual? Or what's unusual about that?
Well, because apricots typically ripen in late June into July.
Well, why were they able to there?
Because they found a genetic mutation on an apricot tree that allowed the fruit to hang on the tree ripe for 2.5 months after normal.
Well, that sounds like you ought to get a cutting of that sucker.
We're hoping we can work out something with them. I mean, it's a pretty incredible tree. It's a trait, and they've some varieties they've created from it, and they're actually apparently exporting fruit to France right now from this trees with this characteristic. Fascinating, really.
So your trials now of 105, is that what you said?
105 varieties.
105 varieties in your... Where did you get all these varieties? Is it all on the same rootstock? How does that work?
It's on the same rootstock. We bud or graft apricots on peach rootstock, which is really reliable for them.
And so that's the rootstock is not the issue.
The rootstock is not the issue.
Okay, no. Good. Rule that out.
Right. We have a lot of varieties from the work in New Jersey that our friend is doing there. There are varieties at the Germplasm Repository in Davis, California, from various countries, and we've brought a lot of those up, the ones we think have promise to try. Mm-hmm. We've collected varieties from around the Northwest in different regions, Idaho, Eastern Washington. Most of them, you know, apricots do wear very well on the east side of the Cascades, like you were saying, in La Grande. Very good climate for apricot. Idaho is really good for them. But so we're just determined. And then we have seedlings from various sources that we have hopes one of those may work out. If we get two or three plants, varieties that will survive and grow here, we'll be thrilled.
Yes. You said that you had a few that showed promise.
Yes.
So what do you do with the others? You just let them go by the wayside, or you just keep growing them to see what happens?
Well, so the strategy right now is we have two plants in pots, and we have two in the field. And the ones in pots are reserve, to make sure that we're giving them a good trial. And the ones in pots we keep under cover so they don't get rained on in the winter. And then we'll see what happens. If the ones in the fields fail, we'll probably consider them all to be that variety, not to be one we want.
Okay, well, don't rush out, gentle listeners, and buy apricots yet. Wait till Jim gets further into this trial. Yeah. I mean, you'll be disappointed with what's available now on the market.
It's very challenging. I mean, I wouldn't say to, you know, not try it if your person's really, really determined and wants
to
do it.
Well, I would.
But you would say that.
Yeah.
All right. Well,
I mean, if you're in the city and you have a small space, you shouldn't devote your time to the apricot.
And what's interesting is there are relatives of apricot that are quite successful, and we've been doing some breeding work. For example, Prunus mumei, the Japanese flowering apricot, different species, but very disease resistant. Compared to apricot, it grows quite well. Its main disadvantage in our climate is that it blooms extremely early. We had mumei plants blooming in January during the warm weather. Then, of course, it got cold all of February, and they didn't do anything more. But anyway, it's very interesting.
Okay,
we'll keep you informed.
Very good. All right, is Martin still with us?
Yeah, I am.
Yeah, good, Martin. Good morning. You're with the Dirtbag.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here.
You're on the air.
So I've got a question on the topic of stone fruit. I've got a couple plum trees, one of which did fairly well for itself last year, which was the second year that it was in the ground. It's a toka plum on a dwarfing rootstock. And this year, I don't know if you can kind of clear this up for me, it seemed to lose all of its flower blossoms very quickly, maybe overnight, as a result of a heavy rain. And since then, a number of its not primary shoots, but certainly auxiliary shoots have lost their leaves and seem brittle. And I'm wondering if you have any insights there.
Yeah. Well,
it'd have to be a very hard, heavy rain to get blossoms off. I mean, like you're described, it seems.
Yeah. It's hard to know for sure without seeing the plant, but I can tell you that the dieback on the branches is a disease issue, but likely bacterial canker, sometimes known as Pseudomonas. Does the tree still have leaves on it, or is it all defoliated?
Yeah, it's got some leaves on it, and initially some of the leaves kind of withered and died, and quickly. And since then, there's been some new growth, but there are certainly some branches that haven't shown any new growth at all since I noticed this initially.
Probably if you were to scrape the bark on those branches where you're not seeing any growth or any leaves, it's probably not. It probably won't be green underneath. It'll probably not be alive. And you could prune that off. Plums are also difficult. I mean, not as difficult as apricots, but they do present challenges, similar challenges with disease in this climate.
The tree grows well.
Some will also suffer the same bacterial canker problems.
All right, Martin, hope that helps.
Well, do you recommend some type of winter spray, or how does one address the bacterial canker problem?
The traditional way of doing that is with a copper spray.
Which is considered organic.
Yes,
even though it's not technically.
Some people question the efficacy of it, but I would certainly give that a try in late fall before the rains start. You can spray and pruning, prune all the dead parts off that you can find, and keeping the plant vigorous is important. So, this time of year, it's a good idea if you can, you know, put some fertilizer around, get some composted chicken manure or steer manure or something to give it some good growth. Don't do that late in the year. Do it now. But that'll that'll also help.
And
so
enough,
plants,
enough water.
Better chance.
Yeah.
And how about covering it? If it's a relatively small tree and I could rig up some type of awning over it over the winter, would less rain on its structure over the winter reduce damage or likelihood of that?
Sure, although that's when you have rain and wind, your structure may be challenged. So, you know, it's not so easy to do that. Certainly, you know, that will there's a lot of we do that with plants. We're trying to keep from getting like we store our plants from the nursery under cover occasionally to keep rain from just they're just happier without all that with all the constant rain and cold.
Well, eventually, what?
Vinyl or something.
Yeah, I mean, you know, again, it's not so simple, and but give it a try if you've got the wherewithal to do it.
I got nothing better to do. Thank you very much.
Well, my philosophy is, you know, it's on its own. Yeah. You know, once it gets established, then you know I'll stake it so it doesn't fall over or anything like that. But
yeah,
sink or swim.
Yeah, and you know there are plum varieties that do better, and some that do worse. And you know the traditional ones were grown here, like Brooks and Italian, do okay, but they also struggle with canker. Oulins is one. Oullins is one that we've grown for a number of years. That's actually very disease resistant. Does well.
What kind of a plum is that?
It's a greenish yellow plum. Very, very good.
Similar
flavor.
To green gage? Or
similar. Yeah.
I grow green gage, and while I do have apparently some canker, the tree, you know, puts out 3 feet of growth every year. So.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much. That's very helpful.
You bet.
Good luck.
Bye.
Okay. We've got a call on line two. Is that correct? Yep. Okay. Good morning. You're with the Dirtbag.
Are you talking to me?
Yes. Yes, I hope so. You're on the air.
Well, okay. Yeah, I live over in Vancouver up at the top of Cascade Park. Very poor soil, rocky, sandy, you know, doesn't hold nutrients very well. I've got an apricot tree. This is my third one, and its principal problem is dealing with Eutypa dieback. I've never heard anybody mention about it. But what I've read up on it, it happens when it gets grafted.
Jim's shaking his head.
Pardon?
I said, Jim's shaking his head like.
I don't think it's an, you know, the process of grafting in itself does not, as far as I know, does not have any tendency to create disease.
Well,
problems.
That's what I read doing research on it, okay? But in any case, this tree is now in its eighth year in the ground, and the thing that I've found that it benefits most by is not watering it at all, not even when I plant it. You know, the previous two died simply because I watered them during the summertime, and this thing is, I mean, it produces not very many apricots this year. It's actually done pretty good. It's got about 18 that are almost the size of golf balls already.
This was a fairly mild winter or February.
Well, the last three of them have been. Last year was the first year it didn't show you type of dieback, but half the tree fell apart.
What are you calling that dieback?
It's called apricot Eutypa dieback. Eutypa.
Eutypa.
Well, that's how I pronounce it. I haven't heard anybody else say it, but that's what I tracked
down. We can look into that.
By the symptoms of it, okay? And the few apricots that I've been able to get off of it that are ripe, I mean, I understand. It's extraordinary. It's like biting into a piece of heaven, almost.
Yeah.
Well, I hope you guys are successful in your trials, because I want to experience a whole tree's worth of apricots before I die.
You and me both.
Tree-ripened apricots. They are extraordinary. I mean, if I found a tree-ripened apricot and I could eat them all day long, I would die a happy man.
I really totally understand, and believe me, it's a real challenge, and with great potential, or you know, the results would be wonderful.
Yeah,
it's why I leave it there, you know, and I just kind of nurse it along, you know, and all the rest of it. I mean, I've got 17 other fruit trees on my quarter acre of backyard, and. Some do okay, some do really well, like the Brooks plums do extraordinary. I've got a peach tree that's been in the ground for 11 years, and last year was the first year it produced an edible peach.
It produced
90 of them, and this year it's got 200 plus on the tree that are the size of the end of your thumb already.
We've been working on peaches and nectarines for a long time, and the kind of results. One of the biggest things with those fruits is peach leaf curl. I don't know if your tree gets it or not, but that
it did the first 3 or 4 years and then stopped. It's like it went away when those stink bugs settled down. It was really weird. The stink bugs seem to have been one of the major impediments to the peaches getting any kind of size or ripeness or anything else. They would, you know, they'd get on the peach and it would cause this huge pucker on it that would turn into wood almost. I haven't seen them for 2 years.
Count your blessings then.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
That's good. Well, all right. Good luck. We'll keep you informed when we have that apricot.
That's right.
Party.
You're going to have to charge a lot for these, Jim.
This was one of those Puget Gold.
Just for
reference.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. We know that variety, and it has been recommended as the best one to try in the Northwest, but it's still not where we want to be yet.
Right.
So.
Yeah. Well, I think the key has got to be the amount of water it receives. You keep that down, and it helps the tree a lot.
Okay, Jim will have to think about that when he's doing his trials there.
I have to somewhat disagree with that, but maybe in your case that's really worked for you well. But
well, it's hard to know, you know, what the groundwater situation
it's
is.
Probably the location too. You know, this is all Missoula flood tail out.
Yeah.
Right.
All right. All right. Thanks for the call.
Well,
appreciate your input.
Good work, guys.
You bet.
Thank you.
Bye, man. Okay, Suzanne, you're up next. Good morning. You're with the Dirtbag. Suzanne fell asleep, got bored, or...
Hello?
Well, you don't sound like Suzanne, but then who do I know?
No, I'm not Suzanne. That was my daughter.
Oh, I see.
You know,
your people.
I don't think she called because she's down in California.
Oh.
Okay.
I have a problem with bacterial canker on my plums. And I'm wondering, I'm wondering if it's killing one tree, and I'm wondering if it would be useful to double graft it with a different rootstock like Lovell that has resistance to bacterial canker.
Unfortunately, the rootstock won't solve your problem. The rootstock itself may not get bacterial canker, but it's the tree, the variety that's getting it. And unfortunately, if the plum is ill from it, that you're suffering from it, it's going to continue to suffer, and no matter what rootstock it's on.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you. I have found that if I don't prune the plums in the spring, they seem to have less canker on them.
That's a very good observation. Actually, we recommend doing the pruning in mid to late summer on stone fruit because pruning in the spring, as you probably can imagine, you know, then we have rain and any disease spores can get into the cambium layer.
And they get into the cambium layer because one has made
a pruning cut.
And so it gets in through that cut.
Yeah.
Exactly, it's something that I'd recommend that, you know, if people do have problems with it, but, you know, I'm on These are on Mariana, mm-hmm. and I guess it has no, well, you said it's the top of the tree that suffers.
That's right, right.
Yeah.
Okay. You do great work. This is a great program. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for listening.
Yeah, bye.
Okay, let's take a music break here. I think we're out of phone calls for now. These all have to do with... Oh, we've got some. We'll still take a break, musical break here. We'll just play a little bit of... these all have to do with watering, or at least water. And this is Lou Rawls. I'd rather drink muddy water.
Got to have our little talk. I ought to pack up my things and walk. I know a dollar goes from hand to hand, but before I let you go from man to man, I'd rather drink muddy water, sleep out in a hollow log. I work for you like a Georgia mule. My friends all laughed, call me a fool. Your kisses are sweet as can be, but before I'll let you make a fool out of me, I'd rather drink muddy water, lay down and sleep in a hollow log. I love you, baby, but you won't be fair. You don't know how to be on the square. Have your fun, baby, if you must, but before I'll have a woman that I cannot trust, I'd rather drink muddy water, sleep out in a hollow log, muddy water.
It's hard to interrupt that one.
Yep. The show must go on.
I'd rather drink muddy water, which we'll talk about after we get to our phone calls.
Drinking muddy water?
Well, speak for yourself. Yes, we are going to talk about watering.
Watering.
Yes, and I posed the question, you know, what's the difference between irrigating and watering? Mm-hmm. Do farms irrigate and home gardens water?
Well,
is there a distinction?
That may lead into actually our garden stumper.
Well, it's about time for our garden stumper. Let's do that, and then we'll get to the calls.
You want
to
do that?
Yeah. Okay. We don't need to worry about our theme song either. We're running out of time here. So this is from, as a result of Jim's travels to New Zealand, somewhat.
Somewhat, right. So this is a, as Glenn said, kind of a semi-scientific one. And the common name of plants all around the world can change depending upon culture, depending upon the region. For example, kiwi.
Aha, hence the New Zealand kiwi, connection.
Yeah, right. Kiwi is the common name for kiwi fruit that we all enjoy and grow.
And let me just interject here, sorry, Jim, yes. But is it known as kiwi around the world?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Go on then.
Russian is kiwi.
All right.
All right.
Go on.
As far as I know, I mean, there may be other names for it. Now, in China, it probably doesn't have that name, but because that's where it's native to. So the Latin name or the scientific name is a much more important name because it is the same around the world. And mm-hmm. it's used by scientists and horticulturists and growers, I mean, to make a firm determination of what a particular plant is. So, for example, kiwi, the Latin name for the typical kiwi fruit is Actinidia deliciosa.
Actinidia.
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 Deliciosa.
Deliciosa.
Right.
Okay.
And in that name, there are two words.
Mm-hmm.
The second word, deliciosa, refers to the species.
Okay.
it could be there are other types of actinidia, other species. The garden stumper question is, what does the first word refer to?
This is just in general, not to kiwi and specifically.
Right, in general. It's a scientific name, and even people have scientific names. I mean, I don't know if they call it the same, that first word is the same for animals, but for plants, the first word in the scientific name, which has two words, refers to what? The second word
refers to
species.
I'll bet you it's the same. I'll bet you it's the same.
Could be.
Yeah. Okay, so if you know that answer, and this is a good one, a little more difficult than some of them. Same number that you call if you have a question, 503-231-8187. Okay, we've got line 1 and line 3 flashing. Okay, we've got line 1 flashing.
Hello.
Good morning, you're with the Dirtbag.
Good morning. I have...
Whoops. We're here. Oh. Well, line 1 will call back. Or, if you know the answer to the stumper, what is the first word in the scientific name
refer to?
Now, why do we say Latin and or scientific? Is it the same thing?
Yeah, it's the same thing, I think.
Because we Latinize those words?
Yeah, Latin, as you may know, Latin is considered to be a dead language. It doesn't change like other languages.
So
it's used in science. That's why... the Latin name and scientific name are...
I see. Somewhere. I didn't know that part either. Yeah. But it seems like they make up kind of Latin-y sounding names.
Who does?
Whoever names these things. For example, the biggest pest for the honeybee is Varroa destructor.
Oh, wow. That's right.
Now, I don't know my Latin. Okay, I'll admit, I don't know any Latin. But is destructor... part of it, or is that Latinized?
Well, I'm sure that's probably Latin. I mean, it's...
Destructor?
Yeah, I mean, there's
okay.
a root
that's,
there.
That's a root of our...
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so they can be descriptive as well as the name of the species.
Yeah, and just a funny quick example of...
We'll get to you, Annalisa, in just a moment here. We have our own discussion going.
Glenn and I discussed this earlier today about common names, and just one really close regional example is the filbert or hazelnut. We in Oregon, we call the same nut either filbert or hazelnut. But the Latin name of that, or the scientific name, is Corylus avellana.
Okay, and then there's cultivars of that, a third name that has maybe a single quote that would be...
Right, and then you can go to a variety. You
know, Gilberto,
whatever. But the actual scientific name of that plant is Corylus avellana.
Right.
Okay, so.
Okay, back to the phone. Are we there? Yes. Okay, Annalise, you're on again.
Oh, good morning.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Oh, that's all right. I have a question about espalier.
Okie doke.
Three or four foot fence, so not a tall fence, that I like to espalier, and it just has posts and metal, what do you call them?
Rails?
Wires?
Wires, yeah.
Okay.
So what is a good plant or flower to espalier that is not too hard for me to prune or whatever?
Well, I may have a different opinion than Jim, but based upon my experience, the first and really only main or strong recommendation is apple. Pear the second, but they're pretty vigorous and they're going to get much taller and bigger than you really want. So
yeah,
apple would be it, and I would make sure that you get the smallest rootstock that you can, and we even call it kind of mini dwarf.
Right. That apple, I agree with Glenn, and I would say, if you... It's a little tricky to find the right rootstock because most places don't offer that size. But like an M27 or secondly an M9, those would be two dwarfing rootstocks that would keep the plant won't be so vigorous. If you have difficulty finding that, you know, a longer-term option is to work with the Home Orchard Society.
Yeah.
And you could start doing that in the fall when they have their All About Fruit show. And you can actually get a plant created with that rootstock. But it's, or you can purchase the rootstock from nurseries and then find somebody to graft it for you.
I would stay away from, sometimes nurseries will have, you know, four-way grafted apple trees, because I don't know what the rootstock would be, but Jim, would you think that it would be the M7 or the?
It would be bigger. It would definitely be bigger, because you, in order to do a four-way graft, you have to get a big, you have to get a good stem, a trunk first to do it.
Yeah.
So
I would stay away from those. I mean, you could ask, say, what rootstock is it on, and then if they can't tell you,
go down the road.
Well, I was at One Green World nursery. And one of the people there recommended figs.
Well,
he said he had figs.
Yeah, but, have you seen a...
And I love figs, but
have you seen
a
fig tree?
Yes, I know.
And how big are they?
Yeah. Well, they get pretty tall.
Yeah, and where is the fruit? The fruit is on last year's new growth.
Oh.
So with an espalier, the idea is that you're keeping these branches tied and then use those branches year after year.
Yeah.
If you have a fig, then you kind of have to start over each year. Otherwise, they just get bigger. And I mean, the fruit's always at the end, so you wouldn't have fruit near the trunk. I mean, it'd be 10 or 12 feet away at some point.
Yeah.
So I don't recommend figs.
Okay. So would One Green World have this rootstock at any, these apple rootstocks?
It's very, very likely. They should have dwarfing apples and dwarf rootstock, and it's still not too late to get it, I think.
But make sure that it's one of those, you know, the smallest dwarfing that's available.
Right. Just for example, and these rootstocks are done by numbers. Now, there are some other newer rootstocks, Geneva rootstocks, and I personally don't even have the numbers in my head because they're like 200 and something. But if you're using the M series, which came from England back in the day, the M27 is the smallest. M9 would be next. M26 would be third, and M7 or M111, those are the biggest ones.
Yeah. It's kind of tricky to keep all of it in your head.
Yeah, I wrote some of it down.
Okay, good deal.
One of my neighbors has a, like an 6 foot chain link fence, and they started pears, and it was just fantastic how that grew. But that's a much taller fence.
Yeah.
On your fence, a very dwarf apple would probably, as Glenn has said, would be, I think, the best solution for you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
You bet.
Bye.
Yeah. She liked us so much, she called twice. Oh, good. Linda, you've got the answer.
So the genus would be the first name, and species, Deliciosa, and the actinidia would be genus, but I didn't know if you wanted the actinidia defined or not.
No, genus.
I noticed a lot of plants I can recognize by genus.
Genus was the word, Linda.
That's what we're looking for.
Congratulations. And did you study plant science or something, or how do you know that?
I study natural history, and I've been in horticulture and botanizing for a long time. I just love plants. My mother loved plants, so.
Well,
I still study them. I still grow up mostly natural plants now, instead of horticultural.
So for the uninformed, count me among them, because I can't remember these things. So we have the species, which is actually the same. I mean, that's the plant right there. Mm-hmm. Species.
Well, you can go to a subspecies or a cultivar variety,
yeah,
of course.
But species, let's talk animals here, because we can understand that a little bit better. They can breed with each other. Is that not correct? Of course.
Well, we won't get into that, because everything gets gray the more you get into it, but pretty much.
Okay. But genus. So what's genus? That's just a further classification, or a higher, or a more encompassing
higher
one.
Higher level, right.
But what distinguishes that then?
Well, I can't remember all the.
Well, I'm kind of asking Jim here too.
There'll be a petal count and a leaf.
So imagine
arrangement.
Imagine these brilliant people, taxonomists, who figured out that these plants are related. I mean, I think it's just remarkable. I was talking to my partner Lorraine about this, like. What brilliant, I mean, you know, what incredible intelligence it would take to, and some plants don't even, like, if Cornus, dogwood, is the genus, and then there's different species, Cornus moss, Cornus natali is the local, is our native dogwood, Cornus natali. Cornus moss is another dogwood, really different flowers. I mean, they're not even, you look at them, you wouldn't even think they were related.
Well, but, the flowers, you know, you look, are probably the sepals. If you get into the heart of them, they're sort of like.
But just think, I just think it's amazing.
We need to have an expert on this,
the
on the scientific names.
It's really different.
Well, you know, we've over the years I've been.
You have to distinguish it from sepals.
Sure. Well, over the years I've been doing this work, I've been playing around with, you know, sometimes trying to graft something onto something else or cross pollinate something with something else. And when, you know, for example, if you're talking about apple, the genus is Malus, M-A-L-U-S,
right?
And then there's all the different species. And in general, you can graft any one onto the other. So,
if you're thinking about the same genus, that would be Malus aforethought, wouldn't it?
Wrong spelling, but nice work. Yes, for sure. Well, anyway, so you can graft, you know, Malus baccata, which is Siberian crab apple, and Malus domestica, which is the typical fruiting apple that we have, and you can use that as a rootstock and all. However, with Cornus, you can't graft Cornus moss onto Cornus natali. It's incompatible. So it's really fascinating, though. I find this.
Well, I'm going to try to get an expert on this.
Yeah, there's one Cornus. I can see that Cornus canadiensis is a ground cover flowering ground cover.
Yes, right on.
And whereas the others are the tree form, the natali and that. Well, that's a good point, and I'll have to dig out my botanical book and read into it a little more. It's been a long time since the class in college.
Well, thank you for the correct answer, and you don't win any prize.
But that's okay. Thank you, guys. I just wish you were on more often than once a month. You're really great.
That's nice thoughts.
Thanks for listening. And and while you don't win a prize, you win our esteem and the esteem of our listeners.
Well, you have my esteem. So
okay.
Thank you.
Well, before we get to this next call, the actinidia, does that mean anything?
Oh, I'm sure it does.
Oh, good answer, Jim.
Yeah. I mean, it was interesting because there are, for up until, I don't know, 10 or maybe 15, 20 years ago, Actinidia delicioso didn't exist as a species. It was all called Actinidia chinensis. And then they were split because they really are two different fruits, significantly different enough to be called two different species. So, but think, though, for a second, Actinidia chinensis from China. Actinidia deliciosa tastes good. You know, those are, they have some.
So if it comes from China, it doesn't taste good?
No,
it doesn't mean that.
It's just emphasizing that it's.
Yeah, that's. Yeah. Yeah. So. All right. Okay, then we did have another call. Tim. Good morning, Tim. You're with the Dirtbag.
Is that Wade?
Oh, sure. Yeah, we meant Wade. That's it.
Listen, I wanted to say, Wade, with tree artistry, and. One, the point is about espalier is you can really keep anything small, and some are easier than others. But just to answer Annalisa's question, I've been growing one for a client, an Asian pear that has three or four different varieties on it. It's not much work, and produces great.
Yeah. Well, I was going to make the point.
Nursery, so I don't know the name, but I know that's a quality place, and it was in this case, certainly.
I was going to make the point that, you know, around the world, they espalier, you know, figs and whatnot, but I was going to make the point that, you know, they have something that most home gardeners don't have, and that's a staff.
Right.
You know, to pay somebody to do it. And so it can be done, but I've seen so many trees that,
I think Annalisa can do this. I'm pretty sure she can.
Well, she can now.
It's small. See, if it's only 6 feet tall, you don't need a ladder and all that. If it's 20 feet tall, it's a whole different story.
And the other thing is that with Asian pears, and I espalier some Asian pears too, and do have fruit on existing spurs, so you're not having to start over every year. But with a fig, you would.
Okay.
That's my thought.
That sounds good. Well, anyways, as long as thoughts are going, I never heard of the aforethought apple, but I did like the previous caller's play with that word.
Somebody ought to name one, huh?
Like a real sour pie, maybe, huh? The malice aforethought. Okay. Yeah. Peace. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Yeah, bye. Okay, well, we better talk about watering.
Yes, it's time.
We're out of calls, I think. So, yes, let's do so.
Okay. So, water.
Yeah.
Get to
the main thing, I think, that with this next water, this next heat that's coming apparently this week, is to take care of your seedlings, the ones that are just coming up that don't have a deep root, and that you may need to water twice a day even to keep that soil moist, and potted plants, because they're going to dry out sooner, particularly if they're young, just planted, don't have a deep root system to draw on that well of water that's deeper.
I was having a discussion on the way up here today about what plants and where they're happiest. So if you have a plant in the ground and it's established, once the roots get established, and listeners should remember, when you take a potted plant and you put it in the ground, first you have to loosen the roots up so they come out of the pot. They're usually round some. You have to loosen them up, put them in the ground. But it takes 2 to 3 weeks for those roots to get established and make connection with the soil. And until that time, it's really important to water the base of the plant.
Uh-huh.
If you water this all around it, you may be keeping the soil quite moist, but the center part can dry out. Where it was originally in the pot, that soil can get quite dry and the plant can die from lack of water, even though the soil around it's wet.
Good point. Yeah. So that's newly planted.
Newly planted, you know, plants, be careful. Keep that center part wet. But don't, you know, after a couple, 3 weeks, the plant will start to grow. Once the plant starts to grow and shows that it's happy, it'll tell you, you know, that it's okay, and now you can just water normally.
Yeah, okay.
But that's one thing. And also, that sort of was the reason I mentioned that. It was because in my experience, generally, plants in the ground can suffer neglect much more so than plants in a pot.
Indeed. They've got the moderating influence of the
nature,
the earth,
soil.
Right? And yeah. There's water to be had.
That's right. It may not be enough. It may not be.
Yeah. Well, like I said, I think, you know, there's quite a bit of water in the ground if it hasn't been disturbed recently.
Right.
I think,
especially here in our area, you know.
Yeah, it's different now than if we had a hot spell in July.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just.
Yeah, that's true. And mulch. I just
indeed.
Was visiting my daughter in Salt Lake City, and she has a cherry tree in her front yard, and I was chagrined to see that she allowed grass to grow all around it, and the tree, while it had some cherries on it, it did not look good. And I said, you know, you really, really need to remove that grass because it's going to pull the moisture and take all the nutrients for itself. And
she's defying her dad even when she's away.
She's probably
rebelling.
I hope she's listening.
Okay, so that's good. But keep the hose handy or whatever watering device you have if you've just planted things. And if you've seeded carrots or something like that, I think it's, you know, get out there and moisten the soil when it gets hot.
Yeah.
We'll say that so they don't dry out.
And I can't help but say also avoid overwatering. Numerous times people have told me they put their fruit trees, for example, in a same place they have their vegetables on some automatic timer that puts water on once a day, and the trees, they don't like it. They really need a good deep watering for a fruit tree once a week.
Because remember, in the soil, the plants need these pore spaces in the air, in the soil, where organisms can be, and they can then the roots can absorb oxygen and whatnot from this pore space in the air. But that's the space that's taken up with water too. So if it's waterlogged, if you will.
Yeah.
Then the plant can't get these other nutrients, and it can, right. You know, drown or starve.
Yep. Roots can rot.
Yeah.
It's
All right. Are we out of phone calls?
No, you have Beverly.
Beverly's with us. Good morning, Beverly.
Hi. I have a plot.
Uh-oh. Arrest that person. Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Hello?
Sorry. Go ahead.
I know I'm on a few lists, but I don't think yeah. Anyway, I have a garden plot in a community garden. And last year, I had a tremendous problem with Johnson grass. And normally people cover their gardens with burlap. And I somehow just didn't want to do that this year. And I'm not having that problem.
Not having the problem with the Johnson grass?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Does that make sense that the burlap could have inhibited or caused them to grow?
Maybe if they weren't diligent. Yeah, because it would still grows by runners underneath.
Right,
and
exactly,
so if they didn't pull it up, then it might be easier to grow underneath the burlap than more dense soil.
Yeah, I was just curious because I see a tremendous contrast, and I did work on it last year a lot.
Well, I think it paid dividends.
Yeah, good. Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call.
Bye.
Bye. Okay, anything else on watering? We'll leave how I plant tomatoes. Let's give it just a brief thing on New Zealand. And Heather, we'll go out with the Wilson Pickett song, so we'll just wait till the end on that. So Jim can give us a minute on New Zealand.
Sure. Well, I went down, this is our third trip, and it was the most interesting one of the three we've taken down there. And I gave a presentation at a local, in a sense, New Zealand fruit growing club. Fruit Nuts, we call ourselves. And it was called the New Zealand Tree Crops Association. It was really fun. And I told them at the end of the presentation, I said, well, this is kind of like becoming my second home. And New Zealand is interesting because it's so diverse, from the North Island, where you can go further, but the very north part of the North Island is pretty much almost tropical, down to we went down to the center part of the South Island, an area called Central Otago. The biggest town is Queenstown. A climate not unlike Eastern Oregon or Washington. Dry, cool, mountains along the coast, protecting it from rain. I mean, it's kind of a similar story. What we were interested in seeing there was the apricots. That was, of course, as I mentioned earlier, one of the most fascinating things I ever discovered, and gustatory as well. And then also feijoa, or pineapple guava, is one of our main goals in our travels there, because New Zealand has taken this fruit, this beautiful evergreen shrub that's native to Brazil, southern Brazil, and made it into a popular fruit. So we've been growing it since I started the nursery. I've been growing this plant, and New Zealand has done all this amazing amount of work, and there are feijoa breeders that we've become friends with and visited them, and it's been just a really, really great experience. So if people haven't been to New Zealand, it's the biggest hassle, of course, is the 12-hour plane ride from San Francisco or Los Angeles.
Wow.
But if you can put up with that, it's a great place to visit.
Well, how are you going to get the apricot anythings? I mean, can you, or is it legal?
But through the quarantine station in Prosser, Washington, is where our hope that will work out. I mean, we still have to work out the details with the people that have it there. And we just want to basically right now add it to our trials, because we don't know how it's going to work in our climate.
Yeah.
But you know, we're hoping at least some genetic materials will be available, and we can see what we can do with it.
Uh-huh. Well, we started with apricots and we ended with apricots.
Yeah, yeah. And in the meantime, like I said, take that 2-hour drive east and check out that fruit stand. And
well, they're not ready yet.
No, of course not. But late June is...
okay.
And actually, I've got a big trip coming up, Glenn. I'm not sure I'll be here in July, because maybe I'll see. But I'm going to... We're leaving here in late June. We're going to New Jersey to visit that apricot breeder. Then we're going on to Uzbekistan. Uzbekistan has apricot is probably the most popular fruit there. And my friend wrote to me recently and told me that their apricots are the size right now of English walnuts. And they eat them green.
Well, that doesn't bode too well.
Well, they start eating them. I mean, they don't eat them, of course, fully ripe too. But they eat them green, and then as ripe apricots too. And they have earlier and late varieties. And then To add to that, we're going to continue on to Korea to visit our friends there and see the apricot, what we can of apricots in Korea. So this will be the first time we're actually going to go all the way around.
Oh, yeah. You'll come back the other way.
And back up in
the
way.
All right. Well, we'll stay tuned for that.
Yeah.
But you'll be here, let's see, next month is June, I guess.
I'll be here next month.
And, okay. All right. Well, we got 5 weeks off this time, I believe. This is the earliest that we can do, the 8th of the month, second Wednesday. Okay.
Yeah.
Glenn Andreessen, Jim Dielbert, this is The Dirt Bag.
Happy gardening.
We'll be back. That's our story.
At KBOO, we accept many kinds of vehicle donations. We accept fuzzy vans, broken cars, zippy scooters, seaworthy boats, well-worn farm equipment, family-sized SUVs, old jet skis, and more. If your vehicle has a clean title, we can take it as a donation. If your vehicle isn't working, we can work with that, too. Call 877-KBOO-123. That's 877-526-6123. Or go to our website, kboo.fm/vehicle.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Feria Day Portland. On Saturday, May 11th, from 5 to 10 p.m.